Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the SFIA monthly livestream Q&A. We'll get started in just a moment, but go ahead and start getting your questions in the chat window so our moderators can start relaying those to me as soon as we start. Please try to keep the questions concise and watch your spelling, and try to be polite to others in the chat. We usually go for about an hour, so you probably want to grab a drink and a snack, though we'll take a break about halfway through, too. With all that said, welcome, and let's get started. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another SFIA monthly live stream Q&A. This is Isaac Arthur, being joined as usual by my wife, the lovely Sarah Lane Fowler Arthur, who will be asking us questions today. As you get queued up and ready to join us for today, go ahead and put your questions in the chat box. Our moderators will find them, reformat them where possible, and get us fed into them roughly in the order they get asked. So with all that said, let's go ahead and get started.
Yeah, it looks like we've got some questions coming in, and the first question we're going to do today is from Raven609. Thank you for your super chat, Raven. And they want to know what your thoughts are about human-powered flight in low gravity, particularly with pedaled propellers or wings strapped to arms.
Let's see. I think the idea of flapping your wings so that that you can fly, kind of like the, Daedalus and Icarus. We actually have the Daedalus Project's one of our names for an interstellar starship drive. We'll be discussing that for our first episode of January. I don't really know if there's ever going to be a circumstance where something with the kind of mass that a human has could fly with normal wings that wasn't like microgravity or very low gravity. You could certainly do that in a habitat, but I don't think you could really do that very well in a in anything but a kind of a microgravity, not like a low gravity like Mars setup.
We already kind of have problems with regular gravity.
Oh, yeah. So, I guess the other thing is you also have to push forward. Everything about flight is inertia, and your inertia doesn't change regardless of your gravity. Your inertial mass has to still be pushed by your arms, which are maybe not ideal for that. Not the kind of flight speeds we usually think about here on Earth. You know, like, how fast were we going the
about
other way?
About 100 knots.
100 knots? Was that? That's actually fairly slow when you think about it, but... 115 miles an hour, still pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
We were up flying last week. My wife is busy working on her pilot's license, and just kind of did a loop around the county. It's so much faster. Ashtabula, where we live at, is the largest county in Ohio, not
we
one
still
of
toured spots, the yeah. entire thing yeah. in like an hour.
Yeah, I don't think it was even that long to actually tour around either. It's real.
That's because we did almost two loops.
But I mean. It's a lot easier to fly in low gravity, but you still have that fundamental thing, which is that it's all about the difference in pressure between the top of the airfoil wing and the bottom. That's what's really doing your lift, and that's mostly about the thickness of the air and the pressure. But the lift you have is being counteracted by your weight, so half the weight, half the lift, you know. All right, so what's next?
Well, we have a question here from Alan Crowley. Thank you, Alan, for your super chat. And actually, it's a comment. He says, keep up the good work on the show and beekeeping. Thanks, Alan.
So, my wife does most of the beekeeping, too. So, let's see. They are, at the moment, all huddling in their frames and very cold. Let's see. For those who, because it's very hard to get access to them, everybody who watches Cody's Lab has probably seen him on doing his bee stuff at times. And he has this one kind of bee setup that looks like a trough. And I think I want to build one of those come next year to keep them in, because it looks like it's so much easier than trying to unstack the boxes to check them. But we'll see how that goes. Was there a question there, or was that just a comment?
It was a comment.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that comment.
The first question here is going to be from Truth Seeker. Do you think Mars colony should be independent or controlled by Earth-based colonies?
I think that it would almost have to be control from back here. It needs a certain amount of independence, especially when it's not got communications. You know, you got that 20-minute cycle time on a message or something in that zone, depending on how close or far away it is.
That's not really that bad when you talk about email time. That's you know, more than quick enough for responses. But it does mean that you can't have anything going on that requires them to be able to talk to us in less than a minute. And so that does require a certain amount of control. But not necessarily any more than you get with, well, like with our local county government. You know, they don't call up the state every day and need a live call with the governor to figure out what's going on. And, you know, it's... they managed to run the thing pretty fine, I should say. So, and of course, this stuff all predated the telephone too. So, you know, it helps to have a certain amount of independence to run things, but you don't really need it that much, even for a modern kind of governmental style, not for that 20-minute or in solar system thing. And the thing people tend to forget is, unless your county's got like a million people in it, it's really not all that qualified to be its own nation state in terms of being things like, where's the appellate court? Do they have a Supreme Court? Or do they have multiple doctors of each specialty? That kind of thing.
Ian Celine, thank you. He says, what are your thoughts on the new Foundation series on Apple TV?
You know, I think I actually made a comment on the Thanksgiving episode that it was okay to ask about that, but I hadn't seen the Wheel of Time series yet either. And I was saying, feel free to ask me about Dune. Awesome. Wheel of Time, a little disappointed, but I'm going to try back and watch after a few more episodes. And Foundation series, which... I didn't like the first episode. I loved the second and third episode, and then after that, it's kind of weak. But, you know, again, Star Trek The Next Generation, fourth season, season one, it was crap. Still a great series. You have to get into the third season before it's any good. And honestly, a lot of the other Star Trek ones, like DS9 and Voyager, are great shows, but they didn't really get their feet underneath them until seasons two or three. I am not happy with all the changes in Foundation, but I do like what they're doing with the Emperor there. It just feels like it's a different story. Cleon is almost a non-entity in all of the Foundation novels except for the Prelude books way later. And he's dead by the time the Foundation series starts up, that particular Cleon. He is an interesting character that they made, though. That almost seems like a different TV show. I don't mind that adaptation because it's kind of cool, but I'm not too happy with a lot of the other ones because it seemed to be removing almost the entire concept of actual psychohistory from the show in favor of just putting math up on the screen and say, look, math.
And so... But, and you're kind of a mathy kind of guy. So.
Well, yeah, but it's not even real math. It's just stuff on the screen. So,
distracting math.
Yes. But, yeah, you know, they are definitely doing a lot more interesting world building there, and there's some material that is good. So I'm going to give them at least two seasons before I write them off, but I'm a little disappointed with them thus far.
All right, our next question is from Jeffrey W., and he says, how far off are Space Labs 3D printing in OG?
Zero-G printing. That is actually... Well, by the way, the Dune movie, because I was going out, awesome, if I didn't always say that. Loved that. I was a big fan of the original, too, so it had to really get up there for me. It was like my second favorite movie after Blade Runner. Best sci-fi movie I've seen in at least a decade. Okay, so printing in zero-G is actually a little bit trickier than it sounds like, because everything we do right now is based off the idea that stuff's coming down off a nozzle to drip into place, basically. So that's going to require a lot of actual real calibration there, though you could potentially run it in like a centrifuge. Obviously, that's an option too, but that might screw you up on some things too. That's the only real hurdle to doing one up there. I believe we took a 3D printer up there and did some stuff already with one, but it's not going to be too hard to actually set up, I think, there. In some ways, it should be easier for certain projects, but mostly it's a practice thing. Within the decade, we should have all the bugs that are specific to zero gravity worked out.
Okay. Jay Lambert says, could stars hidden by advanced civilizations account for dark matter?
This is actually a really popular question because the idea is, hey, well, we are putting a Dyson sphere or Dyson swarm around a star, and maybe that's why we can't see them, and there's all this missing matter. And the problem is no, because first, it would imply that at every age of the universe, right, for every place in the universe we can see, and for every part of the galaxy, they basically distributed the stars they chose to Dyson up exactly how we would expect them to have done dark matter from even so early on that we wouldn't expect any stars to exist yet for them to Dyson up. So no, it doesn't work. Could they be like a percent of the overall? Yeah, sure. Same as like black holes that are smaller than we expect to find, but not quite in the right range. There's a lot of things that could contribute just a little bit to dark matter and be mundane, but none of them are even in the zone to be able to do what we find, which is like a 5-to-1 ratio of matter to dark matter. And the other thing to keep in mind is that when you do Dyson swarm up a star or do almost any other kind of engineering with a star, you're not actually making it dark. You're just changing the spectrum it comes out at. It's kind of like saying that you can't detect a,
a frying pan because you put a welding torch on the in between you and it, and so you'll be like, aha, I can't see this welding torch because I'm covering it with the frying pan. It's still very detectable. You know, it's very hot. You can see it. It will eventually glow visibly, but it's glowing in the infrared in the meantime. And that's basically what it comes down to.
Don't do that with any of my frying pans.
No.
Trusty source says, the universe is 13 billion plus years old and I'm alive at this time to witness this majestic stream. My question is, what do you think humans will do first? Mine Earth's core or asteroids?
That may be one of the most impressive comments I've ever heard about. I'm sorry. What was the actual question again now? Busy being flattered.
What do you think humans will do first? Mining Earth's core or asteroids?
Okay. It's really hard to mine Earth's core without, I mean, certain types of materials that I don't think we're going to get in the next decade or two. Essentially, if we have a situation where suddenly spaceflight gets a lot cheaper, we asteroid mine. If, on the other hand, we suddenly get very good metallurgy and active support structures, like the methods we talked about for drilling gigantic holes into the planet in the Accessing Earth's Core episode, then we do that first. But my hunch would be that we would do asteroid mining long before we ever did Earth's Core. Especially because people are going to be a lot more hesitant to be like, hey, we'd like to machine gun the planet with nuclear bombs to drill a hole in there and let out a massive volcano. You guys okay with that?
No.
No, okay. So there might be a little bit of an absorption factor, whereas I don't think they really care if we mine asteroids unless we try to bring them home to refine them, which we wouldn't because it's a waste of fuel. So asteroid mining first, probably.
All right. Stephen Pilling wants to know if you subscribe to the theory that Venus was habitable until recently.
I guess it would depend on how recently.
Oh, he says fairly recently. Sorry. Until fairly recently.
Even that's pretty hot. I would assume that it hasn't been habitable for at least as long as humanity's been around, just because otherwise you'd probably see all the evidence and debris of some collision having happened. The usual assumption, which there was a lot of debate about, obviously, because we got about Jack for evidence, is that Venus's slow spin is caused by some collision at some point in time, whether that was shortly after the formation of the solar system or shortly before we had the ability to track astronomy, is very hard to say. And truth be told, a detonation like that, if it occurred in anything approaching recent times, and I mean even, you know, in the geological record, would probably show up on Earth as a cloud of debris too, because that's just such a, you know, you talk about slowing a planet down, that energy involved in rotation is actually very parallel to its orbital energy and the energy you need to take it apart with like a Death Star. Very big, you know, very big use of energy. Like a week's worth of solar energy. So it's big, right? But my hunch would be no. Not any time in the last millions of years.
Okay, the next question here is from Niglagador. I'm sorry, I don't think I pronounced that right. In wants to know, what methods of manufacturing do you think that Kardashev Type 2 and 3 civilizations have at their disposal? Nano assemblers, an advanced form of today's manufacturing methods, or something else?
Well, I think one thing we always kind of want to jump on right from the get-go here is the correction of anything being, any K2 or K3 status having anything to do with technology. For the longest time, we had a ban on mentioning any type of any number above 3, except for K9, because it made for good jokes, on our futurism forum on Facebook, just because people were using it as basically, what would super advanced godlike aliens do? To which the answer is, at that scale, what do they feel like, right? When we're trying to talk about defined boundaries, we will have nano assemblers if there's something we can make before we actually have any reason to need a Dyson swarm, with the possible exception of if we is actually something like Skynet, and the reason why it needs them is because it wants to build itself into a Matryoshka brain in the next few centuries. It's not likely there's going to be too much technology of the kind we've already dreamed up that actually operates under known physics that we won't have gotten something better of that's more practical in the next century or two. It's just, we can see that far out, it's hard for us not to get there. Nano assemblers are something we might discover in the next decade. It might be this upcoming century. Whatever it happens to be, it's not going to be one of those things that requires you to have settled the entire solar system or galaxy to get there. So, the basic idea is, though, that Kardashev scale is about how much energy you have at your fingertips. And while that tends to imply a lot of solar, you know, a lot of technology and things like that, there is no correlation. it's probable in my guess that you probably plateau on technology before you ever get to K2. Either that, or you just got whole new levels of physics that, you know, we can't even contemplate discussing by now. So,
all right, I'm going to put out a request that people not use acronyms because I can't interpret them all correctly. But we have a question here from Chris Richardson. He says, "Hi, Isaac and Sarah. Greetings from a chilly UK tonight. Considering budget and current advancements in technology, what system do you think could replace conventional rocketry for LEO first?"
Okay, so for everybody else who doesn't know on that one, LEO, LEO, Low Earth Orbit, it's the area that's about, 200 miles to about 1,000 miles up, give or take. Look up on Wikipedia if you want, though I don't know if it's actually rigidly defined. Usually things which have an orbital time of a little over 2 hours or less. Medium orbits up to about 10,000 kilometers, and then high orbits, everything else up to geostationary at 40,000 kilometers or 24,000 miles, something like that. Don't quote me on any of those numbers. Ways to get to low Earth orbit that would be likely to happen other than rockets. The big thing about orbital rings is, while there, I have actually seen some pretty impressive designs in more recent years of people kind of screwing around the idea of putting an orbital ring up in the next few decades at a reasonably, you know, low-scale bootstrapping approach. However, I generally tend to be of the opinion that if you're looking for something that's not a rocket launch to space in the near future, it's probably either going to be a scramjet, kind of like that microwave scramjet approach we looked at in space planes, possibly combined with a skyhook, or it's going to be somebody going for the mass drive or space catapult approach. The orbital ring and the space towers, they just require... First, they really work their best if you have superconductors, warm temperature or not, that you can actually build reasonably cheaply, and something that's a better magnetic shield than Mu metal. And then if you've got those, they're all about throughput. An orbital ring is like a railroad or a freeway. You build them to places where you're moving a lot of stuff, and they're not profitable to build under most glances until you're there. Right now, we are taking the pontoon airplane out there that can land anywhere on some random body of water, and that's what we're using out to explore this new area. Later on, when there's suburbs and cities there, that's when you build the four-lane highway, and that's the orbital ring.
Sounds like a really great analogy.
Hope so.
Algorn Dianza says, "Thank you, Isaac and Sarah. I enjoy the fun science and the banter between you two. Brightens up my day. Bless you and your family, and happy holidays."
Thank you.
Floor Horbeck, "If we were able to create a bubble of electroweak force around a spaceship and heat up the universe in front and around, could we use a quark gluon plasma drive to travel faster than light?"
No. Let me qualify that by a little bit, because that one's got so much to unpack on it that I'm not sure I'd want to try to do it on the spot anyway. But I can't think of anything that would come from getting us up to anything else than a Planck temperature, which is the maximum temperature you can have in the universe in theory, that would actually have any kind of real warping effect on something like space-time. And in the context that temperature, energy density kind of things can obviously warp space-time too. I really don't see how that one would work, but I'd probably have to think about it more before I just give you an absolute definite no.
WH Colors 999, "When you think of practical ways to harness energy throughout humanity's future expansion into the stars, what's the first thing that comes to mind?"
When I think of practical ways to...
harness energy.
Okay.
Throughout
humanity. Possibly because I just got done recording the episode for the future of solar power, so that's out in sometime in January or February, probably February at this point. Power satellites are really one of my go-tos for real power adaptation. Solar in general, if you'd asked me 10 years ago about solar, I would have said eventually, but probably not for a couple more decades, and that it was getting overhyped. I would say that we're still in the hyped phase, but we are definitely past the extreme overhype phase. The next step is, do we get batteries next, or do we get really compact, reliable molten salt generators for people's houses next, or it's the exact kind of format that's going to run into for what's the thing that gets you through the cloudy days. And that could be we'll discuss in that episode, but that's going to be the other half of that equation, whether it's batteries or solar, power satellites, microwave beaming, nuclear power, etc.
All right. Keelan One says, how would a Dyson swarm be set up around close, medium, and far binary systems?
Okay. Well, for context, there is some disagreement sometimes of what qualifies as close, medium, far. For the record, the Proxima Centauri system around Alpha Centauri and its two bits, we're not even sure if that's actually part of that same solar system, but that would definitely be on the far side. But usually we'd say close if you couldn't actually get a planet in there at all, right? If the two stars were, you know, Mercury distance from each other or less, or maybe a bit more. Medium is when you could actually have a planet system around one, but not much of one. Like maybe each of the two stars has a planet or two orbiting there, or a few AU apart or whatever. And then far would be anything past maybe 20 AU. The difference then is exactly where are with the planets, right? If you're trying to make a stable Dyson swarm, and this is even the point of being semi-stable like you get with two binaries, it gets a little tricky. You probably are going to always want to do it around both of them if they're closer than, say, 10 AU. You'd probably just be better off putting them around each one, or maybe putting your main thing around the bigger one and the smaller one is strictly a solar collector setup or something like that. Maybe you're close than that, but otherwise I'd say anytime you start getting out to the stars closer than Saturn is to our sun, build it around the whole thing. And that obviously depends on whether they are pure red dwarf binaries or if they're some, you know, Spica class ones. So.
All right. We get some unique names on here. The Withering Liberal wants to know if, since the sun is moving in the Milky Way, isn't its light, or part of it anyway, moving faster than the speed of light?
What was the first half of that sentence?
Since the sun is moving in the Milky Way, isn't its light, or part of it anyway, moving faster than the speed of light?
No. Now, light can never move faster than itself, of course, for one thing, but the Milky Way, things orbiting the Milky Way are really not orbiting all that much faster than things that orbit our own sun do. That's why it takes like 200 million years for a sun to go around. The highest speeds you really see out of anything in our solar system, that's all in our galaxy, is, you know, a few hundred kilometers a second, right? Yeah, some things are north of that, but that's because they were an ejected object on its way out of the galaxy that's been kicked out by perturbation, right? And there is definitely an actual time lag involved. If you look at the core of the galaxy versus where we're at versus out on the fringes, time runs at different speeds there. And enough that you could actually not really measure it on your stopwatch, but probably don't need the full-on atomic clock setup if you're wanting to be patient. They're still talking about very slow speeds in terms of the speed of light. 300 kilometers per second is still 1/1000th of light speed, and you'd barely have any real time dilation from that alone. And then the other aspect of that is, if you think about it in context of, like, is the light from the sun going faster than light relative to something that's expanding away from us, that's not really how that process works. And again, it slows how quickly light would get to distant objects, not speeds it up, so.
Okay, well, while we're on the topic of faster than light, we've got a question here from Tumen as well. Isaac, you said that faster than light travel is probably impossible. But of the different theoretical faster-than-light methods, what do you find most plausible?
Most plausible? I mean, I kind of feel like even answering that's a little bit problematic because there's going to be a change in the laws of physics that would make something like that viable. I don't think that anything that allow you to violate causality is ever going to be possible. So probably only something like a congruous hyperspace jump, right? If we have a multiverse setup or another alternate realities kind of setup where you could just do the page turn, like we looked in the Edge of the Universe episode, that's an old nominal hyperspace episode. I say that's probably your one I'd find most plausible to function without some kind of horrible paradox attached. And there's a thing to remember. I think, you know, you have something like a quantum drive that might find the one way in the universe rules you could suddenly drop from one side of the universe to the other, but it might also erase you from history in the process, or find that one backwards reality that makes your event having never taken place, which includes no life on your planet ever existing, you know?
From Albert Jackinson, good afternoon, Albert. He says, good afternoon, Isaac and Sarah. Apologies if my question is slightly broad. How would something similar to a space coast guard work, and would that structure make any sense in the first place?
Oh my. Well, first, as an ex-army person, let me go ahead and give props to you, who actually is Coast Guard out there. It is probably one of the least applauded services that actually works for what's on a daily basis, even in garrison. So, very dangerous job, though, mostly for Mother Nature, but she's really deadly, so it shouldn't be up for long. As the Coast Guard setup, the biggest issue you're going to have with the kind of the classic thought there of them like running up and grabbing your ship is that everything's slow in space. Because it's so huge. I mean, everything's moving, you know, 100 times faster than you do on Earth, but it's so slow because even trying to rendezvous with something that was as close as, like, the moon was is going to take you hours. And like, even a full-on Dyson or Kardashev 2 setup in the inner system out where Earth's at, you might have people who are able to get to things in the minutes, but that would be kind of the localized exception. And in that setup, you might actually have the kind of classic Coast Guard with the little cutter that runs out and grabs people off the ship when it explodes. Otherwise, think of them as the folks who go into the debris, scatter it over several AU in a cone, and try to pick out the life pods and the frozen bodies that they can revive via, you know, advanced technology. Or just the heads. Always like the idea that that's the one thought for like best life support would be that your spacesuit cuts your head off and just keeps the helmet there, so...
That's disturbing.
But efficient.
Jim Whitehead, are you happy that NASA is experimenting with slamming a satellite into an asteroid?
Yes.
And then he comments, it's about time.
Yes. It was probably fairly unfair to President Obama. I don't know the exact headline, but like the day after he got the same day he got his Nobel Prize was when NASA was ramming a satellite into the moon to see what it explodes as. And so somebody done a dual headline. So President Obama gets nominated for Peace Prize, award Peace Prize. On the side, United States bombs moon.
Rememberable headline.
That's certainly it's a good payoff. But I mean, that's kind of a hard joke to resist doing. We, of course, rammed the moon because we wanted to see what was underneath the crust in a way that we really couldn't even do by sending astronauts back to drill there. But, you know, when you ram a satellite into something, that is very energy intense. You know, like a 100 kilogram satellite spike is coming in at hypersonic velocity. It's going to leave a nice trail of dust for you to examine. And I'm glad we're finally going to get around to blowing up some asteroids, too, just on principle. I'm not sure what science is going to be done by that, but it still sounds cool.
Well, let's hope it's something productive. Nick Zink says, is it possible to artificially create multiple habitat planets within our solar system by dismantling other planets and having them house life for billions of years?
I mean, one of the things that comes up, folks will say, well, what if we took Venus, you know, or what if we took Mars and add some of the asteroids to it? Mars' entire mass plus the entire asteroid belt still would not be very noticeably more massive because the asteroid belt weighs an 80th of what our moon does, which is an 80th of what we do. If you jammed every one of the moons and asteroids together, except for Venus, right, that was in our solar system, all your Ganymedes, Plutos, you know, all those objects, Mercury included, Mars included, you come up with one other planet that was in the Venus-Earth mass category. So it's not really an efficient use of mass if you're trying to build large planets. If you are trying to build lots of large planets, then you have, of course, the classic Sherwood options we look at, which is where you go ahead and disassemble something like Mercury or Venus to use as the crust of a large hollow planet that you filled up with something like hyperdense helium or hydrogen, which are plentifully available in large quantity, or even a black hole, which is a good way to make sure you have to worry about the pressure differences of using like a hot gas. And people would usually say, well, isn't that a little bit dangerous to have this planet full of hot gas or a black hole? And we say, sure, it's got a nice core floating on top of this hot gas or this black hole. And that's not really more dangerous than floating on our current core of superheated liquid metal that's highly radioactive. So,
well, when you put it that way.
Yeah. In that context, it's pretty safe.
Thomas Whitfield wants to know what order you recommend a newcomer to your channel watch your videos, from oldest to newest, or what series would you recommend first?
Definitely not oldest to newest. I have the chronological like playlist available to people, and I always add each new episode to it, but that's really more for nostalgia moments for folks who want to go back and like binge it. I wouldn't really suggest watching any of the episodes prior to like the middle of season 2, like episode 50 or so. that's when we start kind of getting better audio and visual. It's actually a little bit painful when you watch all season one stuff just because the AV is pretty bad. That's back when I used to do a lot of the animations too, but which I'm not very good at. Let's see. If I was going to suggest a place to start, what I usually say is look through the last 20 videos, right? Look through the last 20, 25 videos that are at the top list for YouTube. See which of those grab your eye, and then go look at playlists to see which one they're part of the playlist of. And that's probably a good place to start. And then feel free to skip the first couple episodes of the AV is not too good, because a lot of those playlists began, a lot of those series began when the audio wasn't too good. Upward Bound and Outward Bound, though, are the two series that I would usually say are like the first ones you can watch all of, even now, with good production value. The Formy Paradox series, you don't mind skipping the first video, is pretty good, too.
I think this is a good question to go to break on. We have a super chat from Merv Johnson. Thank you, Merv, for your donation. And he says, as an evil crowdfunded AI, what's on your Santa Claus Machines production queue?
What is on my Santa? See, I have this problem is I try not to think about Christmas too much in advance or birthdays, because once I have the gift for somebody, I want to just give it to them right away so they keep the maximum time out of it. And so I actually have a note on my wife's birthday, for instance, that comes up in advance, and for same for Christmas, get her a gift specifically on this date. Do not give it to her before then.
Right, because you like to spoil it by giving it to me early or, you know, weeks in advance, and then the birthday is not as entertaining.
And so I don't actually do too much shopping for anyone I know very well, and for the most part, my wife selects a lot of all ones we get for closer friends. We're doing going away for the old Christmas cards soon, so that's the one I'm probably paying most attention to at the moment. But I would say
they involve electricity, yeah, technology.
They do involve electricity and technology
and
in many cases.
Good old-fashioned hands-on skills.
There we go. also weapons of mass destruction. So, but only for a selected small group of people. It's on the A-list, we call it. We're going to go ahead and go to break. We'll see you in about 4 minutes. So we are halfway through today's show, and we'll be taking a break for a few minutes. And I thought it was a good time to discuss a question that comes up in various forms, but is a bit too short for its own episode. And that's basically whether or not you would use energy weapons on a planet, or some form of bullet or shell. Laser rifles are a staple of science fiction, but the truth is they are very limited in range for use in an atmosphere, and their big advantage is they move really, really fast, as fast as you can see them coming. See the Laser Pistols and Lightsabers episode for more discussion of their pros and cons. However, they cannot be used to shoot over a horizon, for instance, which a projectile like a bullet can do, and speed is less of an issue here. As an example, here on Earth where your horizon is only about 5 kilometers for someone at head height, viewing a flat expanse, light needs only 17 milliseconds to cover that distance, but modern bullets often move at an order of kilometers a second, and rarely can you see unhindered to the natural horizon, so that speed issue isn't as big a deal. However, some high-tech non-chemical projectiles, like an electromagnetically propelled bullet or self-propelled bullet, driven by minuscule amounts of antimatter rather than gunpowder, might achieve velocities of tens or even hundreds of kilometers a second. Now, generally, if you've got a battery able to be manned portable enough and able to discharge fast enough to make a laser rifle possible, you could also use it, and mostly more energy efficiently, to fire metal slugs electromagnetically. So this would seem to make projectiles more useful for combat on a planet. But there is one big problem. If your bullets are moving faster than escape velocity, they won't hit a target over the horizon either. They'll fly into an orbit or escape trajectory. And of course, none of this helps hit a target behind an obstacle like a wall. And unless your enemy is stupid or superbly armored, they are going to take advantage of cover. Now, usually the answer to hitting someone behind cover is just to shoot so much or so hard that it pierces through. But a better method for performance is probably to have your bullet come around and hit the obstructed target from a direction it is not obstructed from. With that in mind, you opt for bullets that are either essentially micro-missiles with their own rocket flame, which also helps to minimize kick in the gun, or something smart, able to determine distance and potentially change its form to become narrow and skinny, or wide and angled like wings or a parachute, to maneuver in the air, and potentially slip into armored targets as a tiny long needle, then spread itself wider inside to shred the target up. Now, this is even harder on airless moon or asteroid with even lower gravity and escape velocity, which is virtually every rock in the universe, big planets like Earth being pretty rare.
Though as a side note, most guns contain their own oxidizer and do not need air to fire, and thus can fire underwater or in the vacuum as a result. This raises one other weapon approach, though, which is good for dealing with armored targets. Imagine you had a torpedo that intentionally shot past its targets, then fired a gun at their less armored flanks or back. This is something which we contemplate with a bomb-pumped laser. Single-use lasers powered by a nuclear blast that pumps out an enormously powerful laser beam in the bare instant before the blast shreds the device. And we envision these on missiles or torpedoes for big spaceships battling over thousands or millions of kilometers. We could create this at a smaller scale with antimatter or antimatter-catalyzed fusion, but we could also imagine a bullet that was essentially a gun barrel itself, able to turn and fire a smaller bullet at the back of the target as it flew past, somewhat akin to a tank saber round. So the takeaway is that we may see a lot of use of classic bullets and directed energy weapons in the future, but that when we start talking about smart weapons, this might be the kind we really see, ones that basically fire guns or other weapon platforms themselves, rather than simple slugs. Alright, with that said, let's get back to the show and back to more of your questions.
So an interesting one that was from Silver Hollow, thank you for your donation, it says, inspired by your break message, I'm of the opinion that every weapon is an energy weapon, just sometimes the energy is more kinetic. And yes, that's a fair point, that you definitely have all these types of energy-based weapons. I suppose some might be strictly non-energetic, be something like psychological warfare. If you guys have seen that Rick and Morty episode where Summer's, you know, keep Summer safe, she's in his car while they're in his, well, car battery trying to enslave a bunch of people. So they always see it strictly being used as psychological warfare, so I guess that wouldn't be as energy intensive.
That's a little crazy. All right. Thank you, Dave Tuttle, for your super chat, and he wants to know what your recommendation for the best Pan Galactic Gargle Blaster recipe is.
I think it involves a lemon being ripe. So you get a lemon, you get some lemon slices, and you wrap it around a large gold brick, and then you whack someone across the head with it. That's apparently the normal description of a pan-galactic gargle blaster. My wife's staring at me like I'm insane because she's not actually read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy yet, so I was just telling her the other day she really needs to listen to the audio drop for that. So. although, I don't know that anyone who's actually listened to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy would actually still not think that stuff in it was insane, but I would definitely say that it makes it sound a little bit less like you're insane when making references to it.
That you have friends. All right. Jamal Inusa says, hi, Arthur. Greetings from Ghana. My question is, how long till we get the type of metaverse Meta is promoting now? How will it affect society, and what types of technology will be needed to achieve it?
I actually have no idea what the reference there is to. If somebody knows what that is, can you kind of post that in there and Cindy just kind of shoot that back up if we, what the metaverse being referenced is? I don't know.
Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
Kev V, do you think we'll ever improvise spacesuits in space or on asteroids?
Improvise them? I mean, you're going to have to at some point in time improvise spacesuits to your location a little bit more, but I think that's, if people out there use them a lot, they're going to improvise both solutions to them on the spot. That's just kind of how that works out. But, you know, like, do you want one that's lighter or leaks air a little bit faster? Really depends a lot on your circumstances. How much weight on tail is okay, how much UV it deflects. That's all very specific to your circumstances and what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. Danger Noodle, thank you for your super chat. What?
The names, always.
Yes. Well, I think that's what it says. I mean, could be a spaghetti noodle that's going to get eaten. It's in danger.
Okay. What was the question?
the question. Hi, Isaac. I am curious about black holes and time dilation. Since time slows down the closer you get from a black hole, is it possible that you can never reach it, as time becomes still?
No, because we usually hold the pullman that freezes is at that very central point, but the one thing I always say about stuff like this is that it's very dependent on how people choose to look at problems with infinity. Singularity is a topological concept. Right? You hear it used in a lot of other things, but what it means is poorly defined, which is to say our current math on it doesn't actually make sense. Examples of singularities are the corners of a cube. Try to describe the corner of a cube properly in terms of where you're at on one of the three sides, and it gets a little confusing, right? As you're approaching the black hole, time slows down, and you're going ever faster, so you're covering distance even faster. And it's basically a Zeno's paradox thing, but the thing is, we know what the answer to Zeno's paradox is. If you take a step towards the wall, and then you take a step that's half as long as another one, and you take another step that's half as much, you still get there. Right? That's how that ends up working out in terms of practical reality. Always be wary of any solutions that involve infinity, zero, or one. So, like, how do you ever know if two electrons have truly got exactly equal mass, for instance?
Here's another interesting screen name. Moop.
Moop? Okay.
Isaac, what's some good military sci-fi that doesn't suck? Something along the lines of Armor or Starship Troopers?
Oh, Starship Troopers is good. That would be a good example of one that doesn't suck. David Webber writes some really good stuff. I've heard a lot of people give compliments to John Ringo. He's been on my list to watch forever, and I keep forgetting. Malky Cooper's Mokiyari Wars is another good one, although I haven't caught up the series since book four came out. I would list those as really good ones to start off with. David Webber, or maybe David Drake is also listed that, though I mostly know him for some of his fantasy work. And Schlock Mercenary is apparently a very popular one on webcomics, but there's a lot of them. Those will get you a good place to start, though. I'd definitely say David Webb would be the one I'd start first with, though.
Okay. This is a interesting question. And I can already guess your answer, so maybe I'll have to answer it for you. This is from C.R. Smith. Will it be possible to eat aliens? And your answer is?
Yes.
It depends.
Well, it does depend. You know, It's always possible to eat something if you want to enough. Right? Let's leave it there. Whether or not it's going to be healthy for you to eat that depends entirely on your civilization's level of technology. So I want you to imagine a very gastronomical race that really believes in going around the universe and sampling the cuisine of their neighbors. Right? They can find a way to eventually find something that's probably not lethal to them in terms of actually eating it, tasting it, and not falling over dead. Although, as we usually say, you want to be really careful because there are so many microbes and differences there. Because, like, was it for one episode, alien beer is a real killer?
Frank, frankly, I love your videos, and I found the self-replicating machines video and have been a fan ever since. I'd love to see a part two focused on Berserker probes. He's a big fan of The Forge of God and the Anvil of Stars books.
Yeah, those are good ones, too. Oh, that's what it was. Alien beer, it's to die for. That was And the joke being that we could tell people not to eat alien cuisine food, but someone would end up bartering the stuff like moonshine and bringing in through, you know, the back channel, and then you end up with some horrible plague overrunning your planet from that. Forge of God is a good one, and so is Anvil of Stars, obviously. I think one of them was our book of the month sometime back. Berserker probes, yeah. So, I think that was Fred Saberhagen. I can never remember if I'm pronouncing his name right. He does a lot of fancy work too, like Book of Swords. That came up with the actual term, Berserker probe, but don't quote me on that. It might have been Paul Anderson. The basic idea is this is a von Neumann probe that goes out there, and its only job is to kill stuff that is not on the approved list. There's often concerns like a terraforming probe would act like a berserker probe too, because it goes around and says, well, this planet isn't really human compatible and we want to make it nice and human, so let's kill everybody on it. There is often argument as to if any probe that was actually capable of taking action would not automatically count as a berserker probe too. I would tend to assume self-replicating probes that are designed to do more than replicate very carefully just for probing would generally be on that list of things that polite civilizations don't throw out into the galaxy, too. I think the berserker probes are probably counterindicated, though, because you can have them just take a little bit of space apart to make just what weapons they need, and we do have an episode coming up that discusses that, memory serves. What was it? Belligerent aliens? Oh, no, that wasn't. It was a different aliens one. By and large, if you actually had a berserker probe loose in the universe or galaxy, the format you'd expect to take was disassemble everything to make guns. That way there's no place for anyone to actually live on or hide behind, and you have a lot of armament to deal with any place that you might have forgotten.
David Richer has a question similar to some of the ones before the break. Could alternate universes account for the mass of dark matter?
No, but dark energy, potentially. There is a tendency to confuse dark matter and energy as though they're related. They could be, because we don't know enough to say they definitely are not, but basically what they have in common is that they're mysterious and there's lots of them. And dark matter is probably nothing more than weakly interacting particles that are weakly interacting in common, like neutrinos or honestly like a lot of matter. Another thing to keep in mind is we got a lot of quarks. We got six types of quarks and three types of neutrinos and three types of, it's horrible. I can't. Leptons, besides those, like the electron, tauon, and muon, and they really don't get used in matter besides the up down ones and the electron. So, for all we know, dark matter could turn out to be some weird combination of those that's metastable. But odds are it's just some kind of weakly interacting particle that we're not familiar with, so like the neutrino. Most of the quarks actually weigh more than, in that mass range where they could do that. As to all the universes being part of that matter effect, I wouldn't think so. Not the way they're distributed, but it's really close to galaxies like a halo. It's just the way dark matter is distributed, and we can't detect it in the gross sense. It acts exactly like something that doesn't like to interact with the particles to accrete like a disk around a black hole would, and just revolve around the galaxy as a big sphere. So.
All right, law of improbability. Would social competition avoid the presumed bias towards long-term population growth in post-scarcity civilizations?
I don't think it would. It's kind of one of those things where it's a little like the basic concept of evolution itself or statistical odds. You really should never expect any protracted period of time going on where there's not a clear advantage to it without it not happening, right? As long as you got a good amount of resources to work with and it's advantageous to have more folks around, you're pretty much always going to head to that direction unless people really want them not to. And you have to ask, well, why wouldn't they want them to? And that's got to be a good enough excuse to like go to war over in a lot of cases too. Not just, well, I feel like I'm, in a population of 8 billion, I just don't feel as special as I did in a population of a million. That one's not going to really fly when you start trying to make laws about it. It's like, well, why should we ban more people? We got plenty of resources and food to give them with all these new worlds. And someone's going to say, I just don't feel all that important anymore if there's so many more people. And I think most of us would respond, if we kind of sympathize with that, too bad. So, and I don't think that would be the case in terms of countering population growth.
Johnny Wings, hi Isaac and Sarah. I love the show. You mentioned that you're doing an episode on the Orion Project soon. Given it's a great power and energy density, could it start orbital infrastructure?
Then the Orion Project episode would be the very next, it's the very first episode of the next year, so one that's not actually up on the screen as we go through. I think vertical farming's up right now. We got everything up through the very last episode of the year. The Orion Project, to me, is almost something you would never actually do in low orbit. I would even not be surprised if the nuclear package was delivered to the ship by railgun off the moon after it had already been kicked up to speed by something like a laser beaming system. As to whether or not it would cause orbital infrastructure to develop while we were building the thing, oh yeah. I mean, even the relatively small Orion generation ships, because you could use them like going to Mars, of course, too, they're smaller. But any of those, like, full-on ARCs, those all talking about, you're talking about multiple billions of dollars worth of manufacturing going on monthly at that point in time, even launch. It's big, it's maybe not quite like Detroit City, Ford, or GM levels of manufacturing for one ship, but you get up there pretty quick.
All right, Pools Jet, thank you so much for your super chat. How about perchlorotase on Mars used for solid rocket fuel to orbit materials?
Perchlorates, also that you need to filter out of the soil on Mars if you want to be able to eat food there. You can use it as a fuel basis. You can use aluminum and ice off of the moon for it too. You can use aluminum on Mars. There's ice on Mars, definitely ice on Mars, and there was aluminum on Mars. I don't know what the exact quarters are at, but I'd be willing to bet it's somewhere in the vicinity the same as the moon and the Earth is. There's a lot of aluminum out there in the solar system. And you probably fundamentally have to find the power source for manufacturing there, and then at that point in time it's just which of them is most easy to actually manufacture with your energy on hand and with the facilities you have on hand. And I'm not a chemist enough to know what the process would be on that, but I would guess you probably want to be using something that doesn't require you to do anything at really at pressure or very low pressures in terms of your chemistry, because that's every extra, you know, pound of new metal for piping that doesn't explode under pressure, that kind of thing. So whatever that would happen to be, with my guess, is the preferred method.
All right. Ricky Simpson is asking if hostile AI is a serious danger.
Yes. Hostile AIs would be absolutely terrifying. I mean, it's hostile intelligence. It depends on how smart it is, but if it's even fairly close to human, let alone more than human, think of it as dangerous. A hostile mind is a dangerous thing. And a hostile alien mind, because either it's an AI or, you know, it's inhuman, whether it's like an uplifted shark or chimpanzee, or it comes from another galaxy, the thing is dangerous if it has a brain. Your neighbors are dangerous. Having you meet is dangerous. And that's got the same attached rider on it, though, is, you know, I think it's a very good idea to avoid making human intelligent AI for quite some time, or uplift animals that are that smart, partially because if aliens show up tomorrow that are as smart as us, you know, they already exist. There's not much we could do about that if we wanted to, regardless of the ethics. If we actually make an AI that's intelligent, or an animal that we've uplifted to intelligence, at that point we got a bit of an ethical responsibility for them too, and I don't think that really permits us to start doing things like putting kill switches in them for safety measures. In which case, you're now dealing with something that's very intelligent, very dangerous, and apparently hostile. Not a good thing.
Right? No, that does sound rather intimidating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would say, if you want an example of why to be terrified of hostile AI, I'd recommend to everybody Holland Ellison's classic short story, I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream. It teaches you why it's good to be afraid of AI.
Silver Harlow, thank you for your super chat. And H has a question. If, let's say, humans start colonizing Mars by 2040, when do you think the first independent states will start popping up? And how would their economy and culture look?
You know, we talked about this a little bit in, well, I think in one of our Mars episodes, but a little bit in our Battle for the Moon episode. I always assume independent states would be, I mean, you might have a couple pop up as micronations that were almost more of like, this nation now exists because it broke away from this big country, and this other big country wanted to thumb their nose at them and is basically bankrolling the whole operation. There should be very few occasions where you have independent nations starting up in this solar system until they are far enough in the future they got millions and millions of people at them. Solar systems, besides ours, they have to be independent nations from day one because they can't get contact home. Otherwise, you assume you almost always stay with your parent nation, even if you got one that you basically like have on a retainer, like Switzerland agrees to be your legal representative for importation customs and UN, right?
Hontus Farmer, thank you for your super chat. And he says, thank you for all you two do. Question, warp drive when? 2150, 2510?
9900, 99,000. Warp drive never.
Warp drive never?
Warp drive
I don't think that was the answer he was looking for. Can you fish around and find a different answer?
See our episode on warp drives.
Is that all?
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to get through some more of them fast. Warp drive.
Sonobello, have you read Inhibitor Phase by A. Reynolds, and did you like it?
You know, I actually just finished up that long ago, and I will say that, I mean, he's still one of my favorite sci-fi authors, probably my favorite. That's one of my favorite series, but I felt like it was a little bit of a weak fourth book for the main trilogy and borrowed a lot of elements that were already done better in Chasm City and Redemption Arc, but it was a good book. It was better than most sci-fi I've read, but I didn't think it was quite up to the standard of that trilogy. So,
okay.
Well, of course, expectations just grow with years, too. It's been a long time since he was in the series.
True.
I definitely recommend that trilogy to one, though.
Rafflecopter Kerman, you mentioned in Fleet of Stars that you could pack enough red dwarves together to black hole the civilization. Do you think that star cluster would continue existing in that galactic mass black hole?
The idea being that if you just keep packing enough matter in one place, at some point it falls in the event horizon. There's some issues there with frame dragging as you're putting stuff in there, but I think they would continue to exist, yeah. I think if you build something that big, you just find yourself on the other side of that event horizon. You keep seeing stuff falling in from the other side, of course. Like the universe would be walled off from you, but everybody else would suddenly see you kind of disappear.
Okay, Krastos wants to know, hey Isaac, what are your thoughts about the dark forest theory? Greetings from Swiss.
See our episode, Fermi Paradox, Dark Forest Theory.
Wait, we actually have a whole one
on
dark forest theory. Yeah,
we have a whole episode on that, dark forest theory.
All right, awesome. Thought Criminal, what do you think would be the implications of the simulation hypothesis being proven correct? If we could prove we lived in simulation. Would you act any differently?
No. You know, the simulation theory is essentially exactly identical, but depending on flavor, to the universe was created by God, a group of gods, Brahma, who in a sleeping state, etc. All you're doing is substituting the word computer in there, which, when you think about it, when it's being built at a higher level than you, probably doesn't even run on silicon, for instance, easily makes it meaningless to call it a computer at that point. It's just, is there a higher layer of reality that created and controls this one? And that can vary a bit, but that's what you're looking at that point in time. People are going to have themselves adjusted exactly as they would if they found out tomorrow that, you know, Brahma was real and was here, for instance.
Vali Abiu, hello from Romania. Love the show. With the upcoming launch of James Webb, will you make an episode about clandestine alien spy telescopes that are watching us now?
That actually sounds like a really awesome episode idea. Spying aliens. If I can think of a cool name for that and remember it until after we're on the Q&A, probably. I like that idea.
He says clandestine.
Clandestine aliens. Someone on the team send me an email or message about that so I don't forget it. Next question.
All right. Thank you, Merv Johnson, for your super chat. And he wants to know if an accelerator launch loop would have to be enclosed, with which constrains ship design options, or is it always best used for cargo pods rather than ships?
You could do a really long one. The big thing that we always have to remember about the acceleration process is that, you know, we say things like Tony radius in order to like turn a ship before it would crush you. The 1G Tony radius around this planet, or the 0.98 one, is actual orbital velocity. That's exactly how that works. If you want to turn around at roughly orbital velocity, you need the radius of the planet to do it in. If you want to do a linear accelerator like that, a big long one, basically the same thing applies. You have to have a lot of distance the faster you want to be going when you come out of it. And you get around that by a higher acceleration rate, so you can do it faster for a cargo pod. But you could build a big long one that was just between like here and Pluto if you wanted to, and send something out of the solar system at, a tenth light speed, we got out, or something like that. The actual mechanics and engineering for that would probably be nigh impossible, though.
I think I skipped Silver Harlow's question earlier. They gave us a super chat. Thank you again. And their question was, any hope for geothermal power before it's too late to help?
I tend not to like answers that involve, like, too late. Obviously, if everybody on the planet's actually dead, then it's too late. But I tend to feel like the best time to do something that was last week is still tomorrow. Geothermal is awesome for passive cooling and heating, or even semi-active heating and cooling, but I don't think it was the main power supply option. Not really for the levels we want to go to. And we, you know, again, solar has really improved. One of the reasons why we're doing that future of solar episode in a couple months here is because that actually has hit that point where it's economically viable now, or at least very, very close to it. So,
all right, and from Isaac Bordeaux, what do you think of the private fusion companies such as Commonwealth Fusion Systems?
There's too many of them that are working on it for me to comment on individually. Like Polywell, for instance, I know of them a little bit better. They're working hard at it. I don't know if they're going to succeed, but they are working hard at it. Whereas you got some that are like cold fusion style companies that are working hard on scamming folks out of the cash. And you have to look at each individual company to know which one's violent. But most of them really are working on a fairly basic premise of like tokamaks, etc., and they'll just see where they can get with it.
This one sounds cool. Daniel wants to know if you do speaking tours, and if so, would you be willing to do one in Australia? The answer is only if I'm coming with you.
There you go. There's your answer. I don't do speaking in public too often, especially with COVID, but the next one I'm set to do is in L.A. for the Rand Corporation in early March, and I think I'm doing one at Glenn Space Center here in Ohio sometime in May.
The NASA Glenn.
Yeah, NASA Glenn one. And that's the only two I have scheduled at the moment. I've done a fair number by Zoom, but that's not in person.
All right. JVal90, thank you for your super chat. I think he's renaming us. He says, hello, authorities.
Arthurites?
I thought it was authorities. You know, you're the authority on everything space and futurism. So my mother actually grew up near you in Amish country. What do you think of the idea of Amish Martians?
I think that they are probably, if your goal is to minimize your technological usages, you know, I would say you'd actually be better off with someone, you know, commissioning you an O'Neill cylinder than trying to actually do a place like Mars. Planets, unless they're like Venus with a solar shade, would be pretty stable, but by and large, terraforming planets isn't really your answer for finding a good place to live that's low tech. You're really all better off at that point hiring an engineering company to build you something and maintain it. But that's going to obviously depend on, you know, which particular brand of anti-technology or non-technology you're favoring.
Okay. Super chat here.
Kind of curious what part, though. He said he was from the area. Middlefield, maybe? We continue on.
He didn't specify. Orion Spur, thank you for your super chat. And he wants to know, what are the odds that all the recent UAPs are simply standard issue alien AI probes recording B-roll footage for a galactic nature documentary or reality show?
To be honest, that's a pretty good option compared to a lot of the ones I've heard. It's kind of up there with my one about how they might be playing, like, basically running traffic while they steal from the Smithsonian or comic book collections or so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You got time for a few more? Yeah.
Yeah, I think okay, so. Thought Criminal says, Isaac, what is your opinion of eternalism? Do you think Einstein was right about time being an illusion and that all of eternity exists at the same time?
I mean, if you look at a multiverse setup where you have basically every possible state the universe could be configured into existing as one universe, then at that point in time, you don't really need time. Time just becomes your position in terms of which of those you happen to be in. And that's a valid way to look at it, especially if that turns out to be true. But, you know, people often ask, why doesn't multiverses violate conservation of energy? And there's two answers to that. One, we don't actually know that it matters if there's, you know, violation of that. It's not necessarily make your whole new universe, though, is the other one. That's just where are you in that quantum position. But I tend to think that I really am not a big fan of multiverse theory, to be honest. I'm a Copenhagen person. One time, one reality, it moves forward. But that's just my preference, not my scientific opinion.
So Tactical Gamer says, hey, Isaac, will there be a multi-alien species UN in the future?
You know, I loved the TV show Babylon 5, and I loved the game Mass Effect 1 through 3, minus the last 20 minutes of Mass Effect 3. Ironically, it's probably the newest video game I've played much. I really don't think that's very likely. I really couldn't see that setup coming out too much. For one thing, it's very reliant on the idea that there'd be fashion-like travel and communication. In the absence of that, I really don't see that happening too much. Though, again, you could easily have Dyson swarms that were, you know, big melting pots of all sorts of local civilizations. So maybe kind of, sort of, but probably not in that interstellar empires kind of way.
Okay. Mark Carter says, if we prove primordial black holes are true with craters on the moon, could we harness their energy?
The thing about that is we'd actually have to be able to say there was enough of them at a good enough density that we could find them, and then you have to go through the effort of, like, actually locating one specifically, getting its vector down well enough that you could actually set up something around it to serve as a power generator, and then, you know, again, it's probably not giving out very strong Hawking radiation, because if it was, they'd be a lot more visible. But either tapping that or finding some way to force feed it and get to spit out more material, and that's, you know, that's iffy. But yes, it is possible if they exist.
Okay, I'm just going to do a few more here. Mm-hmm. Robert, when do you think humans will see the first space-born generation living their entire lives off-world?
I'm not sure if anyone's ever lived their entire life off the, you know, the six main continents. Like, I don't think anyone's ever been born in Antarctica. Obviously, there are a lot of people been born on islands that are not part of one of the continents, but, like, nobody's ever been born at and lived their entire life, or the vast majority of their life, at McMurdo in Antarctica. So I would actually guess something like that. Probably not until you are looking at having populations of at least a few thousand on a given asteroid or planet. And, of course, that first interstellar colony would have that, too. So, not for a century, probably.
All right. And Pack Bandit 13, how likely do you think true AI will be invented and not just really an advanced algorithmic scripting?
I mean, you can always take the standpoint that humans are an advanced algorithmic scripting at that point, but I'd say we already have AI. I mean, not the ones that people really want, where, you know, it's like a genuinely Turing-compliant advanced intelligence that could really pass for human and not in some kind of weird circumstance like, oh, everyone can be forwarded to thinking it's a human when it's pretending to be an 8-year-old boy who doesn't speak the particular language he's talking in natively. soon, though. Next 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. Even if assuming that you don't want to say they already exist to some degree anyway.
Well, it looks like we're out of time for today, and we'll have to queue up some of these questions for the next go-round, but been great being on the show with you.
Oh, I think that was our cue to go ahead and wrap up for the day. So, again, we will be starting off December very shortly here, and the episode for that is going to be our Fermi Paradox episode, looking at digital miniaturization. And we have a lot of ones up for the rest of the month, and we will see you again for our live stream, which I think is on, like, the 30th of next month. So right towards the end of things, but not actually on New Year's